Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. And as you can see, Judge Gould is joining us from Seattle. How are you, Judge Gould?
Yes, I'm fine. Thank you. Good morning.
And we'll proceed to argument in the en banc rehearing of Board of Trustees versus Chambers. From the appellant.
Good morning, Your Honors. The panel majority in this case correctly found that this case is not moot, and then correctly found that ERISA preemption does not bar Nevada law. This is the only approach that both follows Supreme Court precedent and makes sense of the numerous cases in this court that serve as precedent. It's also...
Couldn't the panel have followed Northeastern Florida chapter of Associated General Contractors versus City of Jacksonville, come to the same result, but not, unduly narrowed City of Mesquite?
I'm not sure I understand exactly what you're getting at, Your Honor.
In other words, the plaintiffs are still injured by this different bill. I think it's SB 338 continues
yes.
to harm the plaintiffs, whereas the panel construed City of Mesquite very, very narrowly, reaching a different result, but seemingly in conflict with some of our other precedents. Do you have a view about that?
I do have a view about that. I would say that, in my opinion, the panel majority correctly followed both City of Mesquite and Northeastern Florida General Contractors case. And that's because, as the Supreme Court has said, City of Mesquite is the controlling authority in voluntary cessation cases. The Supreme Court has not treated City of Mesquite as a rare exception to a blanket rule of mootness, as the dissent adopted. And in Northeastern Florida General Contractors, as well as the case of Friends of the Earth versus Laidlaw, the Supreme Court said that voluntary cessation cases are governed by City of Mesquite, and that as a result, there's a presumption that those cases are not moot. Another similarity between this case and the Northeastern Florida General Contractors case is that the new statute that's been enacted, SB 338, retains some of the same problems that SB 223 did. And so, just as in the Northeastern case, this case should also be found not moot because those problems still linger.
So what are those problems?
Yeah, so those problems are that SB 338 reenacts the statute of limitation, and I'll point out that appellees argued that anything less than a 3 to 4 year statute of limitations presented an irreconcilable conflict with ERISA auditing practices.
Well, so 338 changed it to 2 years, right?
That's right,
up from
yes.
SB 223's 1 year.
That's correct.
So what do you mean when you say they reenacted it? They didn't. They changed the statute of limitations.
They amended it. Yes.
You just used the word reenacted. I don't mean to split hairs. I'm trying to make sure I'm understanding your position. They changed the statute in the way Judge Callahan described, yes?
Yes.
Okay.
Much of the statute, however, was reenacted word for word. It's just certain challenge provisions were repealed and certain were amended.
So that gets back to Judge Fletcher's question?
Which
was some problems still remain, and I just asked you which those
yes,
were, and you started
yes.
out with statute of limitations.
So statute of limitations is the obvious one.
Before you leave that, though, why is that at issue in this case? It's not pled in the complaint. There's no statute of limitation live controversy.
It became an issue because of the district court's order, which ruled the entire statute, SB 223, preempted. And so there's a 2 year period where if your claim arose between 2015 and 2017, it's now somewhat unclear which statute of limitations.
No, I understand that, but the statute, there's not a live controversy here with a party that is barred or not barred by the statute of limitations. So why is that ripe?
I I believe...
That's just theoretical, isn't it?
Okay. I don't think so, because the appellees here challenged the statute as a facially preempted, so they challenged the entire statute. So that entire statute has gone away, and I don't know...
So where's the statute of limitation problem for anyone in this case? I understand it might be in a future case, but where's the statute of limitation problem in this case?
In this particular case, there's actually no specific problems.
But isn't that why it's entirely...
It's facially preempted, so there's the appellees don't have any specific issues with the statute that are currently, you know, in a court case going on. Statute of limitations falls into that.
Right, so now that we have a new statute, why is that an issue here for us?
It's the statute
of limitations.
It's an issue only in the sense that it's part, if it's not severable and it's part of the entire statute, the mootness analysis requires looking at how the statute actually operates now, and that SB 338 still leaves the same problems that SB 223
How are you injured?
Had implemented.
How are you injured?
Oh, Nevada is
by
injured.
The statute of limitations.
No, there is a real injury, because Nevada wanted to address the problems that contractors were having in these types of cases. And the statute of limitations was actually a central portion of this law. So this is a Nevada law granting vicarious liability to laborers, basically, to be able to get money, debt collection, from general contractors. What was happening is the general contractors wouldn't receive notice of the suit or any idea that there was even a claim until years later. And then the parties bringing those claims would collect attorney's fees, would collect interest, potentially putting the general contractors out of business. So the statute of limitations being cut down to 1 year from 3 to 4 years was actually a central and crucial component of this law. Nevada has an interest in protecting its laws. It has an interest in protecting its citizens and its businesses.
But you've changed that statute of limitations now, right? You say it was central, but you changed it from 1 year to 2 years. So we're fine going forward. You're just talking about the period from 2015 to 2017.
Yes. If this court finds that, as a general rule, this case is moot, yes.
Excuse me. When the state legislature enacted 338, the district court had vacated the SB 223, isn't that right? So the state legislature would have known there was a 4-year statute of limitations. The old one was in place, and yet they didn't make the 2-year one retroactive. So isn't it the state legislature's determination that the 4 years could stay in place for the 2015 to 2017 period?
As a matter of practical effect, yes. But in this case, because we are arguing that this case is not moot, or in the alternative, that the statute of limitations should be considered severable, we have an interest in maintaining a shorter statute of limitations because it was such a crucial part of enacting both of those laws.
But the state legislature would have contemplated, knew that it was a 4-year when they didn't make the 2-year retroactive along with the rest of the statute.
They would have known that, yes.
Okay, thank you.
So it seems to me, just to kind of finish up on that, I took your point to be that there was, in response to Chief Judge Thomas's question, that there was uncertainty for this period of time between 2015 or for the 2-year period. But in the way that Judge Akuta is explaining, I don't see why there would be any uncertainty, because the legislature did not make that provision retroactive.
There's uncertainty in the argument that we're presenting, that if the case is severable, or if the statute of limitations, excuse me, is severable, then, which we believe should be the case if this court does not find the entire case not moot, or does not find the entire case moot, then there is that, we introduce that uncertainty.
Can I ask you why you changed your position? You argued before the panel that the case was moot. With all due respect, it seems a little opportunistic. You got a decision you wanted or that benefited you from the panel, and then you switched your position. This seems to be precisely the issue that confuses our mootness. We don't want parties to be gaming the system, and it comes across that way, to be honest with you.
I understand that concern, Your Honor. I think the most honest way to explain that is that this court's law on mootness is very confusing, and we made an unfounded assumption about whether the case was moot. I'll point out that when we...
Stuff it's murky.
Yes, definitely. And I'll just be honest, it took me a while to read all of those cases and understand the distinction that the panel majority was making. I don't think my colleagues entered that same level of reading the precedent and really comparing the factual differences.
Well, let's assume if voluntary cessation does not deprive a court of jurisdiction, as the Supreme Court stated in the City of Mesquite, when there is some possibility of legislative action after a court invalidates a law, how does the court determine whether it should exercise its power to enjoin the defendant from renewing the practice? I mean, what's your suggestion? And if the case law is murky, to make it clearer, what should we get rid of?
There's a couple of different ways to approach that, I believe, Your Honor. One is you can look at how, you know, in this case, you look at the facts of the case. So if there's a replacement statute, one of the important questions to ask is, what does that replacement statute do? If that replacement statute completely replaces all of the allegedly problematic provisions of the initial statute, you can find that the case is moot, and that's the Hellerker case. If, on the other hand, the statute leaves in place some of the allegedly problematic aspects of the first statute, you find the case is not moot. And that is those are the cases cited by the panel majority.
But what are the problematic aspects of the first case that support this case not being moot?
The problematic aspects are, number one, the statute of limitations.
That's not
but I know we got okay,
it's
so
just
that's
not problematic.
Not problematic.
So what is problematic?
The notice provisions then.
But I thought you agreed that had already been replaced by the new statute.
The new statute implements, no, we didn't agree to that. The new statute implements two notice provisions that are essentially do the same thing as the notice provisions in SB 223. And I can point you to where those are. Section 4, subsection 7 of SB 223 was replaced in 338 with Section 4, subsection 2. Sorry if that's
but that
getting
seems
a little
so
confusing.
Different from what you are. That's what I'm, and I guess you've said you've evolved in your understanding here, but that's totally different than what you argued before the panel. Before the panel, you said the case is moot with one exception, the statute of limitations, which is not an issue. So now it seems like you're trying to grasp at straws, and we'll look at it. I'm happy to look at it, but I did not have the understanding that you ever made this argument before, that there were differences in the statute that were problematic. That were carried over into the new statute.
I don't believe we made that argument.
So that's never
Your
been
Honor.
Made to the court. There's no briefing on this.
This court has its own responsibility to look at mootness.
But forgive me for interrupting.
And, yes.
What is the answer to Judge Nelson's question? Is
no,
there
we did not raise this before.
Thank you.
And I think that illustrates why this court has an independent responsibility. Because the parties can be opportunistic.
Well, I don't think totally fair, to be frank with you. This is a very complicated statute. We're relying on the parties to come before us. You came before us and told us this was moot. I don't think that our duty goes into assuming and trying to recreate on our own what could be a problem for the parties. The parties are in charge of telling us what's a case or controversy, and you told us there was no case or controversy. And now you've changed your position.
Yes, I'm convinced by the panel majority.
But you never
decision.
Told us that. You didn't even write a letter making these arguments to the court. You, for the first time at oral argument, you're now telling us. And I mean, that's fine. We'll go back and do the work that we have to do. But you didn't even file a supplemental brief explaining these things to us.
That's right. I'm relying on the panel majority's reasoning, which I find to be convincing and adequate.
May I ask a question about the notice, your notice argument? And are you arguing now that the new statute, which notice argument are you relying on? Are you saying that we should strike down the old notice or the retain the old notice provision or the new notice provision? I don't understand when you say there's a difference between the statutes, how that matters here.
Yeah, the same reasoning that the panel majority used in its own ERISA preemption analysis would not end up striking either SB 223 or SB 338. The notice requirements are quite similar. And the reasoning of the court that this is a state-governed right that we're giving, you know, to the ERISA plans and other laborer parties is that we're not trying to impinge on ERISA. And that reasoning applies to both.
I understand that argument, but you would agree that the new statute is not in front of us, correct?
I do agree to that. I think we reached the new statute because of the mootness analysis.
Let me ask you this, if I may. Assume for purposes of this question that the new statute entirely moots out the appeal. Then the question is basically the Mesquite question. What's the likelihood of Nevada reenacting the old statute if we were to dismiss this appeal, that is to say, capable of repetition yet evading review? How likely is it that we will get repetition?
That's a very difficult question to answer. Certainly, the Nevada legislature remains free to reenact. The legislature in Nevada meets every 2 years, and the composition of that legislature tends to change every 2 years. I would assume that, and this is, you know, the party who's arguing mootness really bears this burden to show that this would happen, but certainly the Nevada legislature could do that. These interests still remain.
Before the panel, you argued that there was no way that the legislature was going to do this, that they'd turn the corner. And now you've switched, and you're answering Judge Fletcher saying, well, it could always happen. What in the world are we supposed to believe from the statements that are coming out of Nevada on this case?
I think that this case illustrates how difficult it is to predict what a legislature will do.
Well, but why didn't you say that in the first place? You told us before the panel that there was no way that the legislature had put this to bed and decided it was wrong. Why did you say that if now you're coming up and saying, well, it's always on the table?
Well, the best explanation I can offer is that the Nevada legislature did take out some of the more problematic references to ERISA trusts and plans. So while it imposed the same notice provisions, and as a matter of fact, the ERISA plans still have those same requirements, they're not specifically named in the statute. So in that sense, I think it is true that the Nevada legislature saw that it was probably an error in referencing the plan specifically because it made it look like they might be targeting them. But as a matter of fact, I still, despite your assertions, can't predict what the legislature would do in the future.
Under Mesquite? Mesquite strikes me as a very fact-intensive inquiry, and those were very unique facts, where it was the Supreme Court said it's virtually certain this is because they had the city in that case, the governmental entity in that case, said it was going to absolutely reenact. So if this is a fact-based inquiry and you can't predict, why aren't we in a position of saying this is just entirely speculative, what's going to happen next? Are there facts we should be looking to? Seeing them.
The standard that the panel majority sets out, I think, is pretty usable, and here's what it does.
So, counsel, just to be clear, that's not my question. Okay. My question is, under Mesquite, which I think is a fact-based inquiry, what are the facts here that tell us this is anything other than speculative, that this step will be taken by the legislature?
This case matches the facts of Mesquite.
Because the legislature has threatened to do this?
Because the legislature changed its law in response to an adverse court ruling.
Is there any statement made by... Over here. Is there any statement made by the legislative body or individual legislators or other evidence in the record specifically indicating that the state legislature will reenact 223?
No.
Because those are the facts in Mesquite, right?
Those are the facts in Mesquite, but I don't think they were completely determinative in Mesquite.
The problem for me in reading Mesquite is that we've got footnote 11, in which the court says at oral argument, We were told that the city council has announced its intention to go back to its old ways. But we have in the text, this is now the text of City of Mesquite, there is no certainty that a similar course would not be pursued, which suggests that the test is we need to be certain that it won't be reenacted. So in a way, my quarrel is with the United States. Tell me what you really mean. Is it simply fact-bound, or is it something, unless we can be absolutely sure the Nevada legislature is not going to reenact, then it's not moot. I'm having just trouble figuring out what the court's telling us.
I would say in answer to that question that this court can look to the later Supreme Court cases that cite City of Mesquite, because that's Laidlaw and the Northeastern Florida case, because they don't rely on those specific facts of someone admitting at oral argument that they're going to continue the problematic behavior. Instead, they say City of Mesquite is the controlling precedent in voluntary cessation cases, and that is what we have before us.
Counsel, one of the challenges in this case is the so-called problematic behavior the panel concluded was not problematic at all.
That's
why,
right.
Why wouldn't the legislature just reenact 223 since a panel of this court has said it's free to do so?
That may well happen, Your Honor. And in that case,
if they're now free to do so because we told them that they're free to do so, is that a bit of a self-fulfilling prophecy? Since they may do so, then it makes the case not moot.
I don't understand the last part of what you're asking. If that was a question.
Well, in other words, because we've told them that they're free to go, we've given them the green light to reenact 223, and if they're free to do so, then maybe we should presume that they will do so since we told them they can do it.
And if so, then the case
is, I mean, the whole thing ends up being a little circular.
I agree this is an odd case, and I had a lot of difficulty preparing for that reason, because it really does involve a lot of murkiness, a lot of issues that are unclear both from the Supreme Court and from this court's precedents.
Let me ask you a question that might help over here.
Sure.
Let's assume that Nevada had never passed this law, ever, but it looked like it was going to pass. The governor was in favor of it, the legislature was in favor of it, but it actually had not technically passed. But it looked reasonably certain that it would. Under your view of mootness, could a party file a lawsuit saying, well, I think next week they're going to pass the law, and therefore it's likely it's going to pass, so therefore we have Article III standing to challenge it?
I believe that's what happened in the NOATAC line of cases. And so in that case, because the law was changed before,
I'm saying there's no law
You're
in the books.
There's no law.
No law in the books, but it looks pretty certain there's going to be one. Pretty certain the Vegas odds in Nevada say that this law is going to pass. In that instance, could you file a lawsuit, which I have Article III standing, because I'm saying I think next week there'll be this law? Because I don't see how that's really any different than this situation.
I'm not sure I know the answer to that.
It seems to me, under your theory, it's got to be yes for both, because in both instances you're saying the law's not there now, but I think it's going to be, and therefore we have Article III standing.
Then I guess I would say yes, but by the time, I don't think you can get stand, I don't know. I think the issue is, the difference in that is you're looking at standing and here you're looking at mootness.
Both it's whether there's really a case or controversy here.
Correct, but so, if you're looking at standing and there's no law that's influencing you at all, I'm not sure you could file a suit and have standing. However,
what law is influencing now?
So right now, I think one of the issues is that you have a similar law, 338, that imposes things that are very similar to what the district court found were preempted.
But you
and
keep
that
saying
still
it's
affects.
A similar law, and yet that's totally contrary to what you told the panel. So what you've given us go ahead and answer his question, and then I want to ask a follow-up.
Okay. And so when you're looking at mootness, and I think the Friends of the Earth case explains this pretty well, the difference between standing and mootness. So when you're looking at mootness, it's one of the factors you look at in a voluntary cessation case, is you then look at the new statute. You don't look at it because you're deciding the new statute. You're looking at it solely to make the inquiry as to what exists now, and will the legislature reenact a wrongful statute? In this case, it's not wrongful, so that's, you know, another thing in the mix there. In this case, it shouldn't be preempted.
Is there any question that SB 338 was enacted in response to the litigation involving SB 223?
There's no question as to that, because the legislature specifically said that's why it was doing it.
Under the circumstances, under Northeastern Florida, since that was the purpose, and they did enact things, there are certain provisions like the statute of limitation, like the notice provisions and so on, that are somewhat similar to what was there before and arguably have an impact on the plaintiffs. Isn't that enough to defeat mootness?
Yes.
We would have to decide under Northeast Florida that the statute actually impacts them in the same way.
Yes.
And so what's your best shot that it impacts them in the same way? Because as Judge Nelson said, that's new news to us.
Because the only difference is that instead of referencing ERISA trusts and plans, it says potential claimants under NRS 108 point. I forget the exact citation, but that's really the only difference.
Well, actually, it's not the only difference.
Notice provisions. Of course, there are other differences in between the two.
But as far as similarity, you've mentioned the notice provisions. What else is similar in this case then? Between the two statutes, 223 and 338?
I think those are the three things, the statute of limitations and the two notice provisions. And I'll just make the point that I fully expect that if this court were to find this case moot and withdraw the panel majority's opinion, we'll be back here in a few years because they will sue on SB 338.
Well, let me ask you this.
Fairly certain.
And then we would have briefing on the new statute.
Yes.
So what you're asking us for is an advisory
opinion. But it will be the same issues, the panel majority.
Well, it might be. We'd be guessing. We don't know that.
That's my opinion.
Since I'm the only one here in the panel majority, let me ask you this. Do you find, since City of Mesquite is a Supreme Court case, in terms of the murkiness of, do you find that Carreras, Log Cabin, Republicans, and Heliker provide some inconsistencies with the City of Mesquite?
I think that they create confusion partly because of the broad language used in some of those opinions. However, when you really dig down into them, they are all distinguishable. So the line of cases that includes Carreras, Coral...
Well, I know that I did that.
Yeah,
but,
okay.
But so. That being said, if we didn't have that confusing language that could be looked at either
way. I think things
way.
Would be a lot clearer.
I mean, and part of the concept of if you say something is moot, then it doesn't allow panels to go and express things maybe where they don't need to, you know, to kind of put the kibosh on it going forward, which I basically agree with that concept. But I mean, should we, if we want to have a clean mootness standard, should we just get rid of that confusing language in the other cases and go back to City of Mesquite?
I agree with that, and I think the dissent agreed with that as well. It said that unless there's an en banc decision that clarifies the situation, Judge Wallace would have found this case moot. So I think that is supported both by your opinion and by the dissent.
But Judge Wallace didn't say that because he'd go back to Mesquite. Judge Wallace viewed Mesquite as the exception, not the general rule.
Yes, and I think that was an incorrect understanding of Mesquite based on the Supreme Court's own cases interpreting it.
You're down to about 2 minutes. Do you want to reserve?
I would love to.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the Court. Good morning, Your Honors. Bryce Loveland on behalf of plaintiffs' appellees. With me at counsel's table is Chris Humes and Wes Smith. I will be doing the entirety of the argument today for the plaintiff appellees. The offending parts of the amendment that were created and now completely revoked by the Nevada legislature did not impose preconditions on state-created collection statutes. They instead imposed mandatory reporting and disclosure obligations on ERISA-only plans and their employers. That's why the district court got it right when it granted summary judgment for the plaintiffs and why the district court's decision should be affirmed. However, as has occurred here in the last 30 minutes, and because the crux of the complaint has disappeared, the case itself, the appeal itself, is moot.
So do you intend to challenge 338?
We do not, Your Honor.
I can count on that? I won't be seeing you back when they say there's a comeback case on this?
If we had a challenge to it, we would have already challenged to it.
Well, okay, the Nevada legislature enacted SB 338, which changed the statute of limitations to 2 years, up from SB 223's one-year statute, right? So does a voluntary secession exception allow the board to challenge SB 338 statute of limitations in this action, or must you file a new action in the district court?
Your Honor, the statute of limitations issue on its own is not an issue. What the Nevada legislature did when it amended Senate Bill 223 and completely revoked the offensive provisions is it did just that. It revoked the offensive provisions. It returned the general...
So there's not a preemption issue with 338?
There's not, Your Honor.
Even though this is an official challenge?
I apologize, Your Honor.
Even though your claim initially was a facial challenge to the statute, right?
It was a challenge to the totality of the amendment. The amendment targeted
right.
ERISA plans.
A facial challenge. You're not taking particular instance,
no.
instances, so it's not. In other words, it is a facial challenge, right?
Right, Your Honor. Yes, yes.
I'd like to ask a version of Judge Bybee's question, which is, this comes to us in a very odd setting. It's already odd, and then it gets odder. The ordinary way in which these cases come up, if they come up at all, is that there is a district court holding that says that the statute is unconstitutional or invalid for some reason. While it goes up on appeal, the legislature or the city council, whoever it is the law enacting body, repeals it or changes it, thereby at least attempting to make it moot. In order to avoid, if it really is moot, and I'm attributing a little bit of sort of scienter to this, in order to avoid the appeal. And then the question is, well, what's the likelihood of continuing opposition? But here we have an additional step. The panel has already said now that the statute's perfectly constitutional or there is no preemption, which is Judge Bybee's question, so that if the panel's right on the merits and if the Nevada legislature thinks now what it thought before, and in some ways it's a perfectly sensible, perfectly understandable statute, why does that not tell us it's very likely, in fact, that they'll go back and do it because the three-judge panel on the merits has told them it's perfectly okay? Well, which gives us really quite a different posture than we had, for example, in City of Mesquite. What the narrative I just gave you may be the equivalent of footnote 11 in the City of Mesquite.
At this point, Your Honor, if there's any uncertainty if the Nevada legislature would reenact the offending provisions, that uncertainty is gone. Because in the very next legislative session, the legislature revoked the offensive provisions on a retroactive basis. And then,
but that's before the decision on appeal, correct?
Correct, Your Honor. And then the decision on appeal came out.
Yeah.
September 4th, 2018.
Right.
The very next legislative session, this last session, 2019 session, began in February of this year and
right.
just concluded on June 4th.
Right.
During that time, the majority opinion was in place up until May 22nd of this year. If the Nevada legislature wanted to reenact the offending provisions, they had the opportunity to do so and the blessing of this court's majority opinion.
Well,
to do
maybe,
so
maybe
as
not,
well.
But if I'm a legislator or I'm a staffer advising the Nevada legislature, I say, well, you've got a panel decision, but the thing's going on bonk, or at least they're on bonk proceedings and may go on bonk. You don't know yet. If we then dismiss this as moot, the only decision on the merits you've ever had then, or the Nevada's ever had, is that this is perfectly okay. And once they've got that, I think that's quite a different posture.
Well, you would also still have the preamble of Senate Bill 338, which explained that there was a decision at one point by a district court that found it preempted.
Right, and then there was the decision on the merits by this panel saying that it is not preempted. And the hierarchy is, we win.
Well,
but isn't that what you were arguing before the panel? You argued that the case was moot before you received the panel opinion that reversed the district court. So your position was it was moot then, even though you had won in the district court, and the panel should not have issued, in essence, an advisory opinion, which has created this conundrum now that the panel signaled to Nevada that the statute could be reenacted.
Correct, Your Honor. It was moot then, and it's moot now. The offensive provisions were removed. You see, the original amendment, Senate Bill 223, mandated that ERISA only employers, anytime they set foot on a construction project, had to notify their ERISA plans that they were there. That provision is gone. That's gone. Another provision. Anytime an ERISA plan administrator determined there was a delinquency by any ERISA employer, they had to notify that employer according to a complicated reporting scheme and disclosure scheme. This is state intervention in ERISA-governed reporting and disclosure, as well as infringement on ERISA-governed relationships. With Senate Bill 338, the offensive provisions were removed. What we had there was now you have an original contractor, an outside party. If they feel like something is owed, they can ask. And if the claimant, it's now a statute of general applicability, so if the claimant, including an ERISA plan, wants to take advantage of the original contractor statute, 608-150, then it could provide the amount that's owed. That was what was changed. And so you have now a statute of general applicability. Senate Bill 338 returned all those statutes, the lien statute, the vicarious liability statute, the public works statute, to statutes of general applicability. So you don't have this targeting of ERISA plans exclusively on one side. And then you also don't have the infringement on the ERISA-governed reporting and disclosure requirements.
Let me ask you about the district court opinion. Since the panel opinion was reheard en banc, it now doesn't exist. The only thing we have is the district court opinion. If the en banc panel determined that the underlying case for challenging 223 is moot, what should we do about, in your view, should we do about the district court opinion? Should it be vacated under Munsingware, or should it remain in place?
That's a decision for this court. The cases talk about how it's an equitable decision, so this court can decide.
Well, typically, if you want Munsingware vacation, you're supposed to ask for it. Do you want it vacated?
We're okay with vacating. We would prefer...
We like the district court opinion.
Like that decision. We'd love it to stay. But we understand where the cases lie on that issue, Your Honor.
I didn't get the answer to my question as whether you were asking for it. Maybe you don't want to say one way or the other.
He said he was fine with it, but he really would like it.
Yeah, okay. I got it.
Can I ask a question? If we find this case to be moot, it seems to me we've got a job before us on how to write that. And I mean, I think it would be helpful to get your perspective on that, of like the Noatak case, which seemed to be what Judge Wallace relied on. It seems to me that that is also an outlier of other circuits and how they've approached mootness, or at least the statement that was used in that to require that it's virtually certain that the repealed law be reenacted. That almost makes everything moot. Do you think that there's a middle ground? What cases do we need to revisit is my real question.
The rule was established in Crimmins, and then there's exceptions to the rule. Is it virtually certain the repealed law will be reenacted? But
would you agree that standard in and of itself creates too high of a standard and would moot out too many cases if we applied that literally?
I think Log Cabin Republicans did a good job of distinguishing the cases that lay out the exception. So that would be a case I would look at. There are instances when there is continuing harm or likely continuing harm to the plaintiff, Here we are in a unique situation where the plaintiff is coming to you and saying, we're not harmed anymore. We don't seek the protection, the judicial protection that we originally sought.
If Cremin states the general rule and Mesquite is the exception, I'm wondering about Mesquite, of course, we've talked about that the really unusual facts or was virtually certain there had been a sort of a promise or a statement that the offending provision would be reenacted. But there's also the Florida case. Judge Smith and I are using different names for it. Northeastern Florida is, I think, the way he's referring to it, just to make sure we're on the same page. And I read it as a possibility also, but very fact-intensive, but it would require us deciding that the new provisions enacted in Nevada, and this is my question, do you agree, that it would require that we make a finding that the new provisions enact the members in the same way? That's the threshold question that I want to ask you.
Right. So the Northeastern Florida case was where they reenacted or the new provision still had the same harm. But in that case, the plaintiff was still saying, I'm harmed. I need protection here.
Well, and yes, I agree. But further, the court there said that the new provisions don't fix anything. They harm you in the same way. And it strikes me that that would be a very problematic issue for us to reach without given the state's new position today.
Well, our position is that we're not harmed. And it was the same position 2 years ago before the majority opinion came out. We're not harmed by Senate Bill 338. As I mentioned, it no longer targets ERISA plans exclusively. It returned those statutes to statutes of general applicability.
Okay, but go back up, if you would, to the decision tree. If Cremins is the general rule and Mesquite is the exception, do you agree with the case that Judge Smith is referring to as Northeastern Florida, do you agree that that also sets out an exception if we could find that new provisions impacted plaintiffs in the same way?
Yes. That creates an exception.
And I appreciate you're saying that that's not you. You're not in that boat, but I just wanted to make sure that I understand your view of the law, and I think you've answered my question. Thank you.
Does it matter that the plaintiff says it's no longer damaged if it's a facial challenge and it could affect others in the same way? Does it have to be the same plaintiff that claims damage?
Well, this isn't a class. It's just us here.
I'm just asking whether that is that enough to do it in as far as mootness is concerned.
I don't believe so, Your Honor. And the reason why, we can go back to the Friends of the Earth case, the Laidlaw case that was cited earlier. There's a line in that case from the U.S. Supreme Court in 2000. It says, courts have no license to retain jurisdiction over cases in which one or both of the parties plainly lacks a continuing interest. And we saw the same rule being applied.
An interest in the sense that they believe they are harmed? Is that what they mean?
I'm not exactly sure, Your Honor.
But in a facial challenge scenario, we'd at least have to determine that the statute works the same way or works the same harm, regardless of who the plaintiff happens to be, wouldn't we? Wouldn't we have to examine what the new statute does?
You could.
But you're not making a facial challenge to the new statute.
We're not. And so I would go back also to the Gator.com Corp case, which was an en banc decision by this court in 2005. And that decision quoted that same language from Laidlaw. In that case, you had two parties who had settled. Right? And there was concern about continuing harm because there was, from one side, there was something about a $10,000 settlement that was at risk because of the decision. But in any case, the majority of that panel said that this case has settled and you don't have a party or parties that are still interested in this case. And that's what we had 2 years ago. We had a state was saying they're not interested in this case with the exception of one piece. And we were saying we're not interested in this case at all. So those are the cases I would reference this court to.
What about our line of cases that say that mootness, it's at least a factor in mootness, and I think the panel majority put it as more than a factor, where the statute is amended after an adverse decision below. How much of a factor should that play? It seems to me that it must play some factor in the mootness analysis. I'm not sure that I'm convinced that it needs to play as much as the panel majority relied upon, where should that play and what cases do we look to determine what kind of credibility we give to that factor?
I would go back again to Log Cabin Republicans. That case distinguishes, it lays out the rule, which is the Crankus rule, and then it lays out all the exceptions. And it cites to the City of Mesquite case as one exception, but it also cites to other cases from this court. Coral Construction was one where the district court had upheld the challenged ordinance allowing the county to reenact its earlier ordinance. That's different from this situation. But in any case, that, to answer your question, I would go back to that case.
I want to go for a minute to the SB 338. I'm looking at the Legislative Council's digest. I recognize, of course, that's not part of the statute. But in its comments, the Legislative Council makes specific reference to the district court opinion that you really liked, in which the district court found there was preemption. And it indicated, this bill sets forth amendments that would prevent the provisions of law amended in Senate Bill 228 from being preempted. What role, if any, should that statement by the Legislative Council play in our analysis of, say, mootness?
I think it plays to the legislature's intent, which was to not reenact offensive provisions going forward.
Not reenact
the offensive provisions going forward.
Offensive insofar as ERISA is concerned, but not necessarily vis-a-vis you and the plaintiffs, right?
Correct.
So in every case in which there has been an adverse ruling or a ruling that a challenged statute is unconstitutional, and then in response a state repeals that statute, if the factor that the statute was repealed is determinative, that would mean that in every instance those cases present a live controversy. They're not moot. So it would seem that that factor alone cannot be what's determinative, the fact that the statute has been repealed and that the legislature presumably has the authority to reenact it. So what else should we consider?
We need to look at the unique facts of each case. And I think that's what we see in Log Cabin Republicans, is they have this rule, and then they look at the unique facts of other cases that are an exception to that rule. Here, this case doesn't meet any of those exceptions, because you have a plaintiff who's not continuing to seek judicial protection. You no continued harm under ERISA because the offensive provisions were removed. And the legislature has done an about-face as to ERISA preemption and has done its best to remove those offensive provisions on a retroactive basis. And we had this last session where they did nothing. So trying to prove virtual certainty that the legislature won't reenact the offensive provisions, I don't know how you prove that, but we're as close to as certain, I think, as you can get at this point.
Do you think you have more certainty now than you did when we initially issued the majority because of the failure to, because they didn't do anything this session, which just happened subsequently, or?
I believe so, yes.
Is there an Article III problem if a party is before this court and says that they have no interest in the dispute, that they're not harmed, but that party would be the one advancing the interest of others who are not present? I guess it's a Friends of the Earth versus Laidlaw question.
Yeah. We have no actual controversy here. The plaintiff and the defendant at one point both agreed, with the exception of one issue, this was moot.
I think we have your argument in hand.
Okay.
But I don't want to deter you from saying anything further that you want to address.
Well, I appreciate the court's time and consideration to these issues. You know, ERISA was passed to minimize administrative requirements. Senate Bill 223 was really bad for that. I mean, they imposed these administrative requirements on plans exclusively that infringed on their record-keeping and disclosure requirements. The district court's decision should have been affirmed, but as I said at the beginning, we don't really need to get there because the crux of the complaint was completely removed with the retroactive revocation of the offensive provisions. So,
thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Just a few items, Your Honors. First, counsel for appellees mentioned Log Cabin Republicans. I would note that Log Cabin Republicans is unlike this case in the sense that that statute was completely repealed, leaving no problematic issues. Here in this case, it's our position that SB 338 does retain notice provisions, which are problematic. The only challenged provisions that were actually removed were the definition of damages. But the plans here, the appellees, they still have to provide the same notice that they challenged under SB 223. They also still have to receive the same notice from contractors and keep track of that. They're still barred from filing lawsuits if their notice is not timely, something else they challenged in SB 223.
He just said they weren't going to challenge this new statute.
I still maintain that it contains some of the aspects that they previously did challenge and argued against, and they do still have obligations under 338 that are the same as those they challenged. I think they're not, they, to the extent they don't challenge it, it's because of the repeal of the damages, because it now includes, now includes attorney's fees.
Do you have a single case in which a court has found the case was not moot when the party says we're no longer damaged, and since forcing the plaintiff to litigate even though they don't want to?
I do not, Your Honor. It's my position that Nevada remains damaged here.
Right, but you didn't file a counterclaim, right?
No.
No, so no. You don't, I mean, you don't have anything, at least at this stage of the pleadings, that it's at issue, right?
What's at issue for us is the defending Nevada's laws. It's at issue for us to defend the general contractors who wanted this law. And finding this case moot would only continue the confusion of this case, this court's precedences on mootness. So we've asked that the panel majority opinion be adopted.
One final question. I assume that if we find the case is moot, that you would be requesting a vacation of the district court order under Munsingware?
Yes, it would be quite inequitable to force Nevada to labor under an incorrect district court opinion. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you very much. Thank you both for your arguments today and for coming to San Francisco. And we will be in recess.